This show is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network, the Justice League of board game podcasts. Find out more at dicetower.com.
And welcome to another episode of the Family Gamers Podcast. This is episode 204.
We're here for you, but we're not really here. It's virtual, you see.
Right.
Well, we'll get into that later. But this is episode 204 of the Family Gamers Podcast, and so I have a fact about the number 204. This is even board game related.
All right, lay it on me.
Did you know that there are exactly 204 ways to place three non-attacking chess queens on a 5x5 board?
No, I did not know that.
There are also exactly 204 squares of an infinite chess move that are eight knights moves away from the center.
I'm not even sure I understood what that one meant.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Family Gamers Podcast. As always, I am your host, Andrew, and I am joined by my lovely and wonderful wife, Anitra.
That's me. But before we go any further, we need to say that this episode of the Family Gamers Podcast is sponsored by First Move Financial.
You know that feeling of wanting to finish a movie just because you paid for it, like you rented it from Redbox or whatever, or when you think you may as well finish a game that's just going on and on and on because you've started it, but everybody's miserable?
Mm-hmm.
That's called the sunk cost fallacy. Just because you've already invested resources into something does not tell you if it's worth that next bit of resources to see it through. Maybe it's not. If you aren't enjoying book one, why keep going just because it's supposed to get really good in book five? If you need a sounding board for your life's financial decisions, go to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers and set up a time to talk to First Move Financial today. Thank you to First Move Financial for sponsoring this episode of the Family Gamers Podcast. So I mentioned virtual.
Yeah.
Okay.
What are you talking about?
Yeah. So we're just wrapping up virtual San Diego Comic-Con right now. Of course, with COVID-19, we can't get together in large groups. And so a lot of convention organizers have been replacing those 30, 40, 50, 60, 70,000-person conventions with virtual conventions. And the reason we thought we would talk about it this week is because at the end of this week is virtual Gen Con.
Yeah, so for those of us who have always been Gen Can't in the past, this year, if you want to, you can attend Gen Con.
What's going on, Gen Con, Gen Con? That's an old song from a video game.
The passes are free.
They are.
There's tons of stuff going on. And we're going to discuss a little bit of our thoughts, both positive and negative, about Gen Con this year.
Yeah, there's been some weird stuff with us and trying to like schedule programming involved with us and Gen Con and all these things. So we're actually not going to have one of these crazy long shows where we have interview after interview, which is not going to happen this year. We've already got our interviews lined up for other stuff. But we are going to talk about Gen Con. We are going to talk about Gen Can't. And we're going to tell you about some of the stuff that you should look out for if you've always wanted to experience that Gen Con experience, or there are games that are coming out that maybe you know about, or maybe there aren't any games that you know about and you would like to hear about a couple of those things. We're going to give you the skinny in the second half of the show.
But first, as always, let's talk about what we've been playing. All right. Well, we didn't talk too much last week with the boys at Kidsplaining about what we've been playing.
Yeah, we really didn't.
We have played several games of Wingspan. It's been pretty great.
Yeah. It's a good game.
Yeah.
Just like we talked about with our Engine Builders episode.
We've also been playing some Conclusio.
Yeah, so this is a deduction game from Puzzling Pixel.
It is a pure deduction game, and I kind of love that about it. Like, we need no theme here. We need no special equipment. It's a special deck of cards, 49 cards.
Yep.
And that's it.
Yeah, it's got a mechanic that's very similar to like a Hanabi or a Perlock Holmes, where you cannot see the card that you're trying to deduce, and all of the other players are giving you clues to try to get it. In this game, it's not in any way cooperative, but people still have to give clues.
Right.
And so it's really interesting. It's very easy to understand. We pulled my mom in on a play.
It's not necessarily easy
to
play,
but... I know my mom loves deduction games.
Yes.
I know she does.
She likes logic puzzles.
Yeah, she's probably where I got it from. So we got her in and she understood it like that. There was really no extra explanation needed or anything. So I'm really enjoying that as just, it's a great tiny box game. This isn't even a small box game. This is a, it's like literally the size of a deck of cards.
It is one deck of cards.
Yeah.
Yes.
But the box supports
it's
that.
Also,
it's not like,
yeah,
it's not like a Splendor box for a deck of cards. So this is a great game to throw in a pocket, throw in a purse, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of throw it out and be like, hey, let's do a little bit of this deduction stuff. It's a great date game. You can play it at two players.
Mm-hmm.
Really enjoying that. So we'll have a snap review for that coming up in the next couple of weeks, I think. That is Conclusio from Puzzling Pixel.
The kids also pulled out an oldie but goodie last week, Adventureland.
Yeah, I saw you guys playing that. I was surprised. The kids pulled this out?
The kids chose to play it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It went a little long. And it kind of feels like maybe it always goes a little long, and that's why we'll play it and then put it on the shelf and not play it for a long time.
Sure.
But we enjoyed it. We played a different scenario than we had in the past. Okay.
Yeah, this is one of those Hobba games that doesn't look like a Hobba game.
Yes.
Yeah.
We also turned an existing game into a completely new way to play with Sparkle Kingdom from Breaking Games. This is super cool. It is a free print-and-play coloring game that you use your Sparkle Kitty cards with. It is a really neat way to use the same cards. And even better, if you don't have the Sparkle Kitty game already, they have an online card generator that you can use. Or if you're trying to play virtually, you can use the online card generator to make it easier for everybody to see the cards and play with them and play at a distance. It was a lot of fun. And way more approachable for the younger children in our family than Sparkle Kitty is. Because it's all about the colors and the symbols for this one.
We also, you and I, broke out another oldie but goodie in Not Dice.
Yeah, we played one of the very basic puzzly games in it. And I remember why I like the Not Dice so much. They're beautiful. They're fun to play with.
Yeah, they're these beautiful Celtic knot patterns on these gorgeous emerald colored dice, oversized dice.
Mm-hmm.
They're so pretty. And there's tons of games in that box. It's really a nice little package.
Yeah, that's Not Dice from Black Oak Games. We also picked up a game at the thrift store. Well, you did, because our local Savers is finally open and taking donations again. So we dropped off a huge pile of boxes of donations.
Pulled up, opened the back, and said, just take all the boxes.
Take everything. We've been waiting for months.
Yep.
But then you read in, and you
Come on, you have to. Like, any board gamer knows that you have to go to the Goodwill or
wrong.
Salvation Army or whatever. If you're in the area, just swing by. I mean, I was in and out in, what, 10 minutes?
Yeah. It helps that we know exactly where the games are kept in this particular Savers, so it doesn't take too long to go and peruse the shelf.
That's right.
But you picked up this game called Dragonology.
Mm-hmm. We might have someone in the family who's a bit of a dragon fiend.
You know, if you look back at our old podcast episodes, I bet you could figure it out.
Probably.
It was an okay game. It's a roll and move game with set collection, which means there's a lot of random chance. A lot of random chance.
Sure. Yep.
And it is way longer than it needs to be. But that said, it's not a bad game. They keep it moving and we had fun playing it, and we will probably play it again at some point.
Well, there you go. Can't ask for much more than that, right? If it's worth actually pulling out a second time, then, you know, it's probably worth the $3.99 that I paid for it.
I think we've already gotten our money's worth
probably.
Out of it.
Probably. We also broke out Death Eaters Rising. Harry Potter Death Eaters Rising. This is the Harry Potter reskin over Thanos Rising. And the op who published this one has also announced Plankton Rising, which is the SpongeBob retheme of the Thanos slash Death Eaters Rising game. So this is a cooperative game where you are playing as Dumbledore's Army or the Order of the Phoenix or Hogwarts School. And you are trying to defeat the Death Eaters and you're trying to defeat he who must not be named.
And it is really hard.
It is really, really hard. And it's pretty frustrating because it's really hard in ways that you can't really control a lot of the time. And yes, there's a little bit of strategy, but it is so heavily based on the dice that sometimes good decisions literally don't matter.
I will say that I find this a lot less frustrating than games like City Skyline.
Right. Yeah, this is a conversation that we had in depth.
So for two reasons. One, the whole theme of Death Eaters Rising is this is almost hopeless and we're just going to do everything we can to fight against it.
Mm-hmm.
It feels thematically appropriate that it's so hard. And secondly, personally, I feel much better when I can blame my losing on, like, well, maybe we could have made one or two decisions better, but mostly it came down to the luck of the draw.
I mean, I understand that perspective. You are able to use chance as a scapegoat.
Well,
I get it.
And conversely, when I play Cities Skyline, every time I feel like, am I stupid? I cannot figure out how to progress in the game. So I don't feel that way with Death Eaters Rising. I'm just like, well, I wish we hadn't lost, but we did, and that's fine.
Yeah, I do get that. I do understand that. But just like with a roll and move game or Candyland, which is a flip and move game, I don't feel like I'm the one playing. I feel like the dice are playing, and I find that incredibly frustrating because the agency that I have, I think agency for me is one of the most important things in gaming. And if that means that I'm doing a bad job playing a game because I have all this agency and I don't know what to do with it, fine. That's on me. That's okay. I'm okay with that. And maybe it's my control freak tendencies. I don't know. But this is a really interesting discussion for me because it very much speaks to the difference in our personalities.
Yeah,
where
I agree.
I'm totally okay with getting frustrated with my friends, trying as hard as I can and still losing with a game like Cities Skylines, where at least I'm able to be involved in every decision, or the group is, it doesn't need to be me, but the group is involved with every decision, versus a game like Death Eaters Rising where literally, it's more than half of the game is chance.
Yeah, and the choices you make in the game are all about playing the probabilities.
But only kind of. I mean, yes, like, the different colored dice weight differently with the stuff, but how many times were we like, okay, we need a wand, there's a 50% chance of it being a wand, I roll the same die three times and I don't get it. And it's like, there's nothing you can do about that, and that is so intensely frustrating to me that I'm just like, But that being said, if you love the Harry Potter universe, you're right. It's incredibly thematic. The cards are great. Everything about the game is great. The giant, he who must not be named, figurine is...
Which you like picking up by the head to spin him around.
I do. I pick him up by the head and then just like, almost like you're snapping your fingers and just twirl him around. And he's got a nice weight to him. I mean, the production quality is excellent. I think the cards maybe could have been slightly higher quality, but everything about it is good except for that chance thing that drives me bananas. That being said, if I'm hanging out with people that I like, I can deal with that and I'll play the game. But like for me, and because you use that as an example, if my choice is between Cities Skylines and Death Eaters Rising, I would rather try and fail and at least know that I was affecting the outcome substantially more than in a game where I'm rolling chance cubes over and over and over and over again.
Huh?
Because the way it works is you start with one wizard, which means you start with four dice. And it's really hard to get a second wizard if you can't roll well. And
yes.
It's just infuriating.
We'll probably go more in depth on the really frustrating aspects of the game when we write our review, which will be soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't disagree with you. It is a frustrating game, but I find it frustrating in an entirely different way and a way that I am much more capable of dealing with, I guess.
I mean, look, I can put myself in the right headspace to be fine with the
game. Sure.
It's fine, but it's very much like a learned thing. Like Claire, this game is not for Claire.
Oh, man.
Because she has not learned the ability to compartmentalize like that.
Yeah.
And you just have to. You have to play the game for grins and not care about what comes out on the dice.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, it's like, okay, fine, but that's a social experience. And I have 400 games in my house. I can find a better social experience.
Yeah, I gotcha.
So that was Death Eaters Rising. I think we played it three times this week.
Just trying to find
different permutations of player counts and these kinds of things and see if we could find something that was easier or at least more achievable.
Yeah, but in our plays this week, we never even got to the Voldemort card in the character deck before losing the game.
I guess the one thing that I can say about this game is like somebody could look at our relative success or lack thereof and be like, man, you're terrible at that game. And be like, nope, I'm just rolling dice. You can't blame it on me.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's a positive.
Since we were just talking about a cooperative game that is hard, you and I, just before recording this, played Endangered.
Yeah, Endangered is not as hard as Death Eaters Rising.
It's definitely not as hard.
Because you're making decisions. And yes, there are dice in this game. There is chance in this game. We have now established that Anitra is a very bad tiger breeder. Like, this is a fact.
I roll to breed the tigers, and every time I'm rolling, like, a six, and I need, like, a 1, 2, or 3.
This game is so funny because almost every single time when you roll, you want lower numbers. And I had forgotten that when we started. So I come out the gate first round. I'm like, boom, 6, 6, 5. Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, great. I can't do any of the actions that you placed your dice on. Cool.
Yeah, so that was a bummer. But I really love this game. It is so fun to play. It's so pretty. It's so pretty. So pretty. And it's a game about saving tigers or saving sea otters. Or there's an upcoming Kickstarter for an expansion that has 6 other animals. That
Yeah, polar bears and all kinds of other stuff.
Panda bears and all this stuff. And it's not strictly about the physical act of saving these animals. It's about going and appealing to the ambassadors or doing all these different things. And you play as
it's a balancing act.
Yeah, you play as all these different asymmetrical characters. So like I was a TV personality. Crikey! Oh, I'm going to go and get on TV and raise some money to save those dang tigers. Or what? I just went Southern or something. I don't know what
you
I
totally
did.
You totally did.
I apologize to everyone in Australia who listens to the show. I'm really sorry. I'm bad at accents. But anyway, I was Steve Irwin. I mean, that's who I was.
Yes.
And you were the philanthropist?
I was a lobbyist.
You were a lobbyist? Okay. Yeah. Something having to do with money. I don't know.
Playing Endangered, it's a balancing act of physically keeping the animal's habitat from being destroyed and animals with it, trying to get enough mating pairs together to make more, while also raising money, gaining influence, helping the rest of your team members in whatever ways make sense. In our game, it made sense for me to try to do things where I discarded cards because that gave you money and then you could use the money. And all of the different ambassadors you're trying to influence have all kinds of different conditions. Some of them are really random, like roll a die, and if the number is, you know, this big, great. And others are based on your dwindling resources of money or cards or habitat or anything like that. But it is hard. I think technically we lost, but then you had me re-roll the last 2 dice and I happened to get them just right, yeah, which would make us win.
So we technically
on the last
lost.
Move.
I think in BGG, in board game stats, we lost.
Yeah, we lost.
That's honesty. We're gamers of principle on the Family Gamers.
But we had a ton of fun, and it's the kind of game where you get into the groove a couple of turns in and be like, okay, we do this, we do this. We meet this threat, and this other threat is not that important right now, and kind of go
and
back and forth.
One of the other things
that's
really interesting about the game is that as we were going along, we realized that the resource that was dwindling was no longer things like the deforestation, but the number of turns that we had left, because we got to the point where we figured out how to manage deforestation and we could push it back so the tigers had more room and maybe we could do some other stuff. But then we're like, oh, wait, but there's only 9 turns in this game.
Yeah, like we need to spend our last, 3 turns just dumping influence on ambassadors as much as possible.
And we absolutely saw the effect of that, because once we stopped fighting deforestation, it just closed in around our tigers and we had a really hard time. So it really is an interesting balancing act, both from an ecological standpoint, but also from a political standpoint. And that's so much more true in the world than almost any other game that I've ever played where you have to do this kind of stuff. Because,
yeah,
I mean, yeah, it's a game, right? So there's always a suspension of disbelief when you're playing a game, but usually you're out in the woods, you know, saving the chimpanzees or something, and it's in a vacuum and you don't think about the rest of it. And this is a game that really explores both sides of that.
Or even Rescue Polar Bears, which we reviewed about a year ago now. Which does abstract out a little bit of this to say, hey, your main goal here is get a bunch of data.
Right.
The idea is like you're collecting data and then you're going to bring that back to people who are going to help you save the polar bears. And you have to let go of the idea that you're actually trying to save as many polar bears as possible, because what you're trying to do is get data before too many polar bears die.
Right. Which, I mean, if you think about it, is almost like just a brutal perspective.
Kind of heartless.
Right? It is totally heartless. And it's really a reframing of the challenge that the game presents you with.
Yeah.
And I think once we realized that, the game became, I'm air quoting here, a whole lot easier for us. This is a game where you literally have to protect the tigers. Yeah, or the sea otters.
So I feel like Endangered does a better job of showing you that balance.
Right. And I think it's been pretty critically well received. I don't actually think it's sold a ton. I don't think the Kickstarter went gangbusters, but everybody who's played it has liked it. And we actually have some friends that are coming down next weekend who got the game just before the COVID lockdown, and they haven't had a chance to play. And I sent them a picture of it tonight, and they are very excited to be able to break that out next weekend. So looking forward to that.
Cool. And that was Endangered by Grand Gamers Guild.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of very excited, we got two games in today that I have been raving about for almost 6 months.
Months.
Yeah. And the international board game community agrees with me.
They do.
They do. So literally today we got in a package from Cosmos that included The Crew, which just won the Kennerspiel des Jahres. We announced that, I think, last week or the week before. And we also got a copy of My City, which is a game that I have been over the moon excited for since the moment I saw it at New York Toy Fair. And
I mean,
came home, and it was the game that I told you about. It was like,
yes,
of all of the games, of everything that you have seen here,
like,
this is the game I am pumped for.
City building, polyomino, legacy game,
Reiner Knizia. And that's pretty much it.
Sold.
And I've been, you know, having back and forth conversations with Tom Wetzel, who's been on the show, who does a lot of the marketing for Cosmos. He's been excited to get it to us because he really wants to hear our perspectives on it. And so it's just been this rolling boil for the last couple of months, just waiting for this game to come out. And it's actually technically not out yet, but we were able to get a copy courtesy of the team at Cosmos, and we played a round of My City tonight with the kids. How do you think it went?
We played the first episode.
The first episode. So there's 8 chapters, and each chapter has 3 episodes. So there's 24 episodes in the box. So that kind of implies that a 24-episode game. How do you think the first one went?
I think it went okay. I think the kids got a little frustrated because this is a tile-laying game, and you're penalized at the end of the game for open spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be really careful in planning out how you lay your tiles.
Yeah, I ended up having to pass twice. So there were 2 tiles that I wasn't able to use when I played. You only had to pass once.
I only had to pass once, which is why I ended up winning our first game.
By a fair amount. You won with 15 points and I had 10. And then the kids had 0 and 3, respectively.
That's probably because I covered 4 more spaces than you did.
No, I understand. So the pass cost me a point.
Right.
That you didn't have to pay for. And then you covered
and
4
And then
more
I also
spaces.
Covered 4
like,
more
I
spaces.
Get it. I get where it came from. But it's not like it was 100 to 95. It was 15 to 10. So
yeah,
that's a 50% increase over my score.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm sure that'll work itself out in the wash at the end. This is a legacy game. So at the end of the game, the 2 kids who were lower in scoring were able to put stickers on their boards, which opened their boards up 1 more square. So they've got a little bit more room than we do going into the next episode, which is going to be easier for them. You had to put something on your board that actually would potentially hurt you.
A potential penalty if I can't cover it. Yeah.
If you can't cover it up. I just kind of sat in the middle and did nothing.
Your board gets to look the same.
Right. So I'm really excited to play that more. I really, 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 really hope they don't tire of it too quickly.
Yeah, me too. I think you and I are going to love this game.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's going to be a little bit more hit or miss with them. I think we need to find good times to play it because they were getting a little frustrated after the first game. So then we pulled out The Crew.
Yeah, so one more thing about My City. I really do think that this is a game they will enjoy, or at least Asher will enjoy, because it is a family weight board gamey game. Like, it feels like a...
Yes.
This sounds dumb to say, but it feels like a board game. Like, you're playing the board game and you're like, we're doing board game things in a board game. Like, Endangered doesn't feel like a board game in that way. There's some kind of meta feeling in my head, at least. It's like, this is a board game. I'm board gaming with a board game. And My City totally has that. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy.
I think the other thing is just that learning a game is always harder than playing a game.
Probably.
So we kind of forced our kids and ourselves to learn 2 brand new games tonight. And, you know, working through that for the first time is not easy. So now that we know how to play, even with it being a legacy game and having, you know, a few new rules each time we play, we don't have to start from scratch.
That's true. But speaking of that other game, The Crew. Kennerspiel des Jahres winner, The Crew. This is a trick-taking game. So I really recommend that somebody read the rule book and internalize the rule book before you sit down to play. Because in truth...
Because we didn't.
It's not complicated. It's a trick-taking game. But there's enough different stuff going on. Because it's a cooperative trick-taking game.
Yeah.
There's enough stuff different going on that there's a fair amount of rule explanation that ultimately boils down to something where you could... just present the rules, and then any questions, you could field the questions.
Yeah.
But a rule book has to be able to anticipate everything and kind of put everything in there. And so it's a little bit hard for the rule book in that way. Like, I actually love the presentation of this game. I love the way they have a 22-page rule book, and they say, start playing after 11 pages. Right? We talked about this with the Funko games. They do the same thing. And then if you flip the rule book over, like, I thought it was going to be in a different language or something, because that's, you know, that
it's a pretty standard different thing, language
manual thing. But no, when you flip the rule book over, it's the logbook, which tells you the story of the mission to find or seek out Planet Nine. And that's what's going on in this game. So this is a cooperative trick-taking game with 50 missions in the box. And you're reading through this story trying to find Planet Nine or find the secrets of Planet Nine.
Yeah, so this one isn't a legacy game, but it's what we would call a campaign game.
Yeah, like an episodic game. But in reality, all you're doing is this trick-taking stuff. And you know what? Reminds me a little bit of Spy Club, which they call the Mosaic game, because the restrictions or the rules or the goals or whatever are very variable. They actually change every time you play it. The guardrails around what those things are doesn't change, but the actual things themselves do.
What you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, so at least so far, we've played, I think, 3 missions?
That sounds right.
Yeah, so what happens in the beginning? I'll just explain the first mission. It says, okay, so there's this deck of task cards. And the first mission is you have one task that you need to complete. And the task cards are basically half-size versions of the regular cards that you have, which are normal trick cards, right? So you have a bunch of different suits, which are just different colors. There's what amount to jokers, which are rocket ships. And there's one task card that gets flipped up at the beginning. And whoever the commander is, who has the highest powered rocket, takes that task card. And all that task card means is the commander has got to win the trick that has in it the card that matches the task card. That's right. It. And so everybody at the table, everyone's goal is to make sure that at some point, the commander wins that trick.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And it's just super interesting because of the way... Oh, you can't talk. There's also that.
We went through all this rules explanation and all this, like, and this is the one way you can give hints and everything. And then we got into the first end and we're like, oh.
Yeah.
And like one or two of us gave hints and then we played the first trick and we managed to win the scenario in the first trick. Right. And we're like, oh, that was it. Okay, let's try the next one.
And I think it's hard because I don't think the rule book is poorly written. I just think that this is a thing where the rule book has to anticipate every question. And so it has a lot of explanation in it because it's unlike any other trick taking game I have ever played. But what did I call it? I called it like the spring training of trick-taking games to you because it really forces you to think about all the different ways that you can communicate without communicating and all the different ways that you can manipulate the group around you to do things without flat out saying, yo, I've got the 6 in red and that's the one that you want. You can't do that. So I found it really, really fascinating to mull all this stuff over in my head while trying to figure out how to play the cards out. And I thought it was really, really, really cool.
So that was The Crew from Cosmos. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a few other things we played this week. I spent a fair bit of time with the kids playing Quirky Circuits as I was trying to put together our Snap review, which went up on Friday. I really like Quirky Circuits, and it ranges from pretty easy and pretty straightforward to fiendishly difficult, all within the same package, and you can kind of pick your difficulty level and where you want to be. So highly recommended if you or your kids have any interest in programming especially, because it gives some real insight into what goes wrong with robots.
We'll have the Snap review for that included in the break for this show, so you'll definitely understand what I need you talking about.
We played some more of Claire's Cake Stack prototype game. I am really pleased to see all of the thought that she's putting into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to walk her through what are the important elements of playtesting at this point in the game when everybody you're playing with it is familiar with it and also its flaws.
And they're people you know, so they, you know, are going to be nice to you.
Yeah.
You and I sat down last night and played Biblios, which is a game that we hadn't played in a while. We've been trying to go through some of the games that have really been collecting a little bit of dust, I think, and making sure that we want to keep them, basically.
Speaking of which, the kids pulled out Quingo. Mm-hmm. And we have played that 3 or 4 times in the last couple of days. I'm reminded why we like it so much and why we gave it such a glowing review, I don't know, 3 years ago now?
It's been a while.
Because it is so simple, and the only real knowledge it requires is how to sequence numbers. And it's quick. We had one kid friend over for a play date, and we taught them how to play it in 2 moves. I really like it. That one was Quingo from Game Right. You should just look up our written review for that on the website.
The only other thing we played Virtual Hues and Cues with the charity Board Gamer and Scott and Nicole Brady, who are the creators of the game.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Rachel Blasky was there. A whole bunch of other cool folks.
Amanda
Ken
Panda.
Franklin, Amanda Panda. It was a lot of fun. This week we're playing Wavelength.
Yay!
That ought to be fun as well.
All right, well, that about wraps it up for what we've been playing. We've been playing a lot.
We have. It's been awesome. I have played a lot more games this week than in recent memory, and that's been great, and I've been very thankful for that. We do have a very small bit of news, something I personally am excited for. Thunderworks Games announced a sequel to Cartographers, the Rollin-Wright, called Heroes. Looks fantastic. I'm excited. We'll have more, I'm sure.
Yes.
And congratulations to Roar and Wright. They wrapped up their Kickstarter the other day, and that was very successful. We kickstarted that. We had Carla on the show a couple of weeks ago. Very, very glad to see that that was so successful.
Well, why don't we take a little break? And when we come back, we'll talk about Gen Con and other virtual cons and Gen Can't and what you can do.
Yeah, how you can get the most out of these free experiences.
We'll be right back. Kids love robots.
Robots are fun.
This is evidenced by the growing pile of remote control
things,
robot
in,
things
our house.
In our house.
Useful robots are even better.
In Quirky Circuits, you cooperate to program robots to do useful things. Kind of.
Well, one of our kids wants to program robots.
So this is a great place to start. This is Snap Review for Quirky Circuits, a hidden programming game by Nikki Valens. Quirky Circuits is for 2 to 4 players, ages 8 and up, where they cooperate to give a robot directions, and it's published by Plaid Hat Games.
Quirky Circuits comes with a book, and to set up the game, you open the book and you choose a scenario. Each scenario uses one of the 4 robots, each with its own specialized deck of cards, specifying how that robot moves and does special actions. We strongly recommend starting with Gizmo, we call him the Kitty Roomba, which the book actually recommends as well. He's the first few scenarios in the book.
His goal is to clean up dust bunnies.
Set up according to the scenario book. It's a spiral-bound book, so it sits flat. It's very easy. And you can easily read the setup and the goals and the special requirements on one page while using the scenario-specific game board on the opposite page.
So that's the setup. Let's talk about how to actually play the game. Every round, players will play cards from their hand face down out to an action row, one at a time. Once a card is down, it can't be moved to a different place in the lineup. Like in the game The Mind, players are not allowed to communicate in any way, except for robot beep-booping, and they have to guess at what their fellow players are thinking.
This is classic deck programming. If you've played the game Colt Express, this is something that would be familiar to you, but this is a cooperative game.
However, unlike in The Mind or Colt Express, the cards do give some clues here. As players put out their cards face down, the card backs reveal whether each card is a movement, a turn, or a special ability.
Once players have cooperated to put out 5 or more cards with at least 1 from each player, it's time to resolve the card actions.
Turn the cards over 1 by 1 and resolve each action. Sometimes you'll realize you've made a horrible mistake as your robot interacts with the environment in unexpected ways.
Some of the different robots do this in kind of hilarious ways, I think. After resolving all the cards, move the battery indicator down by 1. This is basically your turn tracker. Shuffle and redeal the cards to all players. They keep any unplayed cards they had from the last round, and you're ready to try it again. See if you can meet the scenario goal before that battery runs down to 0.
Let's talk quickly about the 4 robot characters. each one has its own type of goal and its own idiosyncrasies in the way it operates. Gizmo, the kitty Roomba, the kitty vacuum, cleans up dust bunnies while trying to avoid breakables, because if you break them, you have to clean them up too, and tries to avoid barriers, which will spin Gizmo around and point it a different direction.
Twirl is the gardener bee. Twirl delivers seeds and fruits around the garden. He's very helpful. Rover, the dog bot, digs up fossils and delivers them to their displays in the museum.
He's adorable.
Mm-hmm.
Lefty is a robotic sushi chef with the most challenging scenarios. He's going to pick up, chop, spin, and use conveyor belts to deliver sushi to the demanding cats of Robotopia.
If this isn't enough for your robot experts, the last four scenarios in the book include animal tokens that will move around and mess up your robot's plans. So, Anitra, what do we think of Quirky Circuits?
Quirky Circuits combines programming and multiplayer cooperative play in a way we've never really seen before. Players are trying to cooperate to get the robots to do the right thing, but what one player thinks is right might not match what another player thinks. And of course, you're bounded by the cards that you have drawn in your hand. The deceptive card backs add to the confusion. Gizmo, we talked about the kitty Roomba, its move cards include a forward one, a forward two, a backward, a sideways move. Those are all moves. It can feel, when you're playing, like a bunch of kids all grabbing for a remote control as your robot ends up in a wildly different place than where you had planned.
One of the things that's great about Quirky Circuits is this requirement that every single player has to play a card into the row for each round. This is good because it makes sure that everybody stays involved. They don't just kind of sit back and watch everybody else do it, which they might be doing because they just want to disengage or because somebody else is trying to take over. Everybody has to be involved.
But they might also do it because they look at their hand of cards and say, there's nothing here I can play. So it also keeps the challenge level high, saying you must play a card from your hand, even right. if they all look terrible.
Yep, like any good cooperative game, there is a sense of accomplishment as you progress, not just when you win a level, but basically anytime you accomplish a goal along the way. For us, when we played, pretty much the first time we played any scenario, we lost.
Just about, yeah. Yep.
And it took some time to start thinking similarly.
The four robots and the 24 scenarios ensure that there is plenty to explore in this game. It's not a game to just play a handful of times and move on. Instead, you can work your way through progressively more challenging levels, or do like our kids and skip to the robot you like most.
They like Lefty. I mean, I like Lefty.
Lefty the sushi chef is really cool and really hard.
Really, really hard. Each of the robot figures is detailed and cute. We wanted to pick them up and play with them immediately. Other than Gizmo, they all have functional pincers or mouths to hold the tokens, which is super cool as well, as they transport them around the board.
The box says 8+ for this game, and that's about right. Pre-reading children, like our first grader, can successfully play, but they'll do best with a grown-up to help them with the setup and the understanding of a scenario's goal, and you may have trouble getting them to leave the bot on the board instead of picking it up to play with it.
That's right. The game is easier with less players. It's the most winnable at two. You can really get in tune with the other player, and you can use meaningful looks to communicate what cards to play and when to play them. But the game is just crazy fun when you play it at four, with robots going basically almost out of control, it seems like. With four players, actually achieving goals feels like a fluke, but if you do it, you've got three other people to high-five.
We found Quirky Circuits useful to get our kids thinking about action programming and a little bit of what that looks like in the real world. Since we're both trained software engineers, we want them to understand that robots and computers do exactly what you tell them, and if you make a mistake, they'll do that too. And small errors are quickly magnified once you keep going through the rest of the commands that you've set in place.
Quirky Circuits is a fantastic improvement on the game that really created this for kids, which was Robot Turtles, which has been around for, I think at this point, almost a decade.
I think you're right. And unlike Robot Turtles, Quirky Circuits is a really quick play at about 10 to 15 minutes for the easier scenarios. You can pick it up for about $35 on Amazon or ask for it at your local game store.
That's right. So, Anitra, what do you think we're going to rate Quirky Circuits from Plaid Hat Games?
I'm not going to give it quite a perfect score because some of these scenarios are really frustrating, but everything about this game is so great, I want to give it 4.5 robots out of 5.
That's a half a robot more than the robots in the box.
And that's Quirky Circuits
in a snap.
And we're back.
We sure are.
Before we start talking about Gen Con and other virtual conventions,
Anitra has a mischievous look on her face.
I have a Fork Science.
Yes. You even teased me with this for science because it's one of my favorite candies of all time.
I went to the grocery store They have Halloween candy out. It's July. I'm not okay with this.
Is it a Reese's pumpkin?
No.
Oh.
We already know how those taste.
That's true. That's
delicious.
True. That's also true. I'm hoping this is delicious.
I am skeptical.
Okay.
But so we'll see.
Before you say what it is, I want you, and I will be honest, I will be 100% honest, to give a rating from 1 to 10 on what you think I will rate this after I eat it.
From 1 to 10, yeah. Where 10 is like Reese's?
Like, yes. 10 is Reese's and
normal, 1 is the A&W review. And
10 is Reese's and the normal Kit Kats, the ones that I like.
Okay. My guess is that you'll give this something like a 7. Like,
oh, okay.
Not bad. It's fine. You know, I like it. I don't think I would get it again.
I don't think I would get it again. It's probably like a 5 or a 6.
Maybe a
7 is something like a whatchamacallit bar where I'm probably not going to want it, but like once in a while.
It might hit just the right itch.
Yeah.
Well, this could in fact be in there.
Oh, okay.
So this is a Kit Kat that I saw on the end cap next to the Halloween candy.
Okay.
Even the cashier who rung me out commented on it. And I was like, yeah, I don't know.
But it's technically not Halloween candy?
It is not Halloween candy. It was next to the Halloween candy.
Did it have a clearance sticker on it or anything?
No.
Did it have a nuclear waste symbol on it?
No.
Okay, I'm just checking.
It is a limited edition Kit Kat apple pie flavor.
Oh.
It is white chocolate.
I mean, that's good.
And some kind of apple pie flavored filling?
Crisp wafers in apple pie flavored white cream naturally and artificially flavored? No way, I'm not eating this.
A Kit Kat artificially flavored?
I know,
You're
right?
Kidding
right.
me.
Okay, here we go. So I'm opening this up. They look like, you can hear it. It's this is the ASMR like audio podcasting. Oh boy, they have a very
apple-y smell.
They smell a lot like, well, it's a very artificial apple. Not even quite the quality of Yankee Candle. It's not great.
There's a lot of spice in the smell too.
Yeah, there is. Okay.
Well, you only have to eat one out of the 4. Yeah, knowing now that the apple flavor is in the white chocolate, I am even more skeptical.
You know what? There were some bad flavors lurking as I was chewing. But as I start to blend the flavors in my mouth, it's not that bad. I get the apple pie. I don't even really get the white chocolate.
It's just a delivery mechanism.
Kind of. I definitely get the apple pie flavor. It's not as good as, you know, real apple pie.
An actual apple pie.
But I get the apple pie flavor. I don't think this is world changer or anything. It tastes like, if I were to imagine, like an apple crisp ice cream, that's what this tastes like.
Okay. Yep, I can see that.
It's more apple crisp than apple pie, I think.
Sure.
But it's not bad.
For those who don't know, because I've found out that there are people who don't know, the major difference between an apple crisp and an apple pie is that an apple crisp does not have a crust, top or bottom. Basically, apple crisp is the lazy way of making a big pan of apple dessert.
Well, so I make an apple crisp pie.
Yes.
Which is apple crisp in a pre-made pie crust.
Yes. Which is delicious.
Here, try some of those.
I don't know, man. I'm not a big white chocolate fan either.
You can't taste the white chocolate.
I've had things with this flavor before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an artificial apple flavor.
There's definitely some natural apple and spice flavor in there too, though. Like, it actually, this is going to sound ridiculous, but I eat Lara bars on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the apple pie Lara bar, which is like dried apples and cinnamon and dates and some kind of nuts.
Yeah, there's definitely cinnamon. I can definitely taste the cinnamon in there.
There's definitely cinnamon and nutmeg. And probably another spice, but I'm not sure which one.
Yeah. So, wow, that was actually not bad. I mean, do you want more?
I'm going to finish the bite that you gave me just to get it off my fingers. But
and then you don't want that. Okay. So not enough for Nietzsche to have anymore. There is candy sitting next to me, so it's going to get eaten. So I will eat these. They're not wretched. They were not the chili powder coated, whatever those things were. But now, you know, if you like really artificial apple pies from the supermarket, like the really artificial ones.
The ones that, if you like the like Little Debbie apple pie bite things that come out around fall time.
If you eat those and secretly hate yourself, but also secretly love what you're eating,
You'd probably like these
apple pie flavored Kit Kats. But otherwise, you can probably pass. And so, I probably wouldn't quite go to a 7. I'd probably go to a 6.
That was not too far off.
You weren't that far off. But that is for science.
For science.
All right. Let's move on to the show topic this week.
So, we're going to talk about virtual conventions in general.
Right.
But mostly Gen Con, because Gen Con has gone 100% virtual this year.
This year, yes. So, the reason why we're talking about this now is because it's literally this weekend. So, when it is safe for you to do so, head on over to a computer, go to GenCon.com. You can register for a badge for free. There is tons of programming that you can check out. We'll get back to that in a little bit. But you should definitely go and register for a badge so you can sign up for events. First, I think we need to talk about the OG virtual convention.
That would be Gen Can't.
That would be Gen Can't. This is, I think, the 6th year of Gen Can't.
Either 6th or 7th,
I think it started in 2014, I thought.
Yeah, that's right. It started in 2014, so this would make it the 7th one, because that includes 2014.
Oh, okay. I can't do math, sorry.
Year math is weird sometimes.
But anyway, so let's talk about Gen Can't. So Gen Can't is something that you, admittedly, have kept a closer eye on than I have.
Just a little bit. I always thought it was interesting to celebrate the largest gaming convention in the United States with a similarly branded but unaffiliated, completely virtual event.
Well, I mean, I think it makes sense because it's the biggest one in the United States, but it's still 70,000 people.
Right.
And there's a lot more people in the country than 70,000 people.
There's a lot more board gamers than that.
Exactly, exactly. And a lot of people can't go to something like Gen Con. Gen Con pretty much sells out, so... Mm-hmm. If it's something that you want to go to, maybe you can't afford it, maybe you couldn't get to it in time, whatever the case may be, this is an opportunity with Gen Can't to do something else that still celebrates that time.
Yeah.
And of course, obviously, like we said before, this year, everybody gets to do those things.
Everybody can. Gen Can.
With every convention. But just talking about Gen Can't specifically, it really was started by really the community having a little bit of a conversation about all the things they were missing out on and saying, you know what, we don't have to do this. We can do our own thing.
So Gen Can't is a much smaller, more intimate affair, actually, than Gen Con, because it's the kind of thing that happens when you have an entire online community and just say, hey, participate in what you feel like.
Right.
So it's actually a little bit smaller this year because so many other conventions are online.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they feel less need to replace the convention experience. However, they're still planning a photo contest of some sort, a contest for mini painting. They're going to have a raffle like they do every year. Folks like us and publishers donate games to be then raffled off. And whoever donated the game also is responsible for shipping it.
Yep.
And they have some hosted events like Mega Plays, games that are being played online that 100 people or more can join in at the same time. I think the ones they're having this year are going to be hosted by Ruel Gaviola, Mandy Hutchinson, the Girls Game Show folks. Also on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, there are going to be interactive quiz shows and sorts of things like that hosted by Bruce Vogue.
We all love Bruce.
Such a personality. He's great. There'll be a couple of interviews with board game publishers or board game designers. And they're even going to have Gen Can't karaoke on Saturday evening and Gen Can't Jackbox to wrap up the weekend on Sunday.
Sounds like fun. So that is the OG, the original unconvention Gen Can't.
Worth noting is everything in Gen Can't is 100% free. You don't even need to technically register for most events because it's Gen Can't. And you can do a lot of the stuff on your own schedule.
All right. So that is Gen Can't. Going to be a lot of fun as usual. Let's talk about Gen Con. The normal Gen Con happens in Indianapolis every single year. It is the Indianapolis Convention Center and also Lucas Oil Stadium, where the Indianapolis Colts play, which is just a gigantic amount of space. It's kind of incomprehensible to me.
Because 60,000 people is a lot of people.
Yes, it is. It is a lot of people. And obviously with COVID, it's not happening. So we have virtual Gen Con, which is, I think, good and bad. I think it's probably good for the greater board gaming community, but I think it's probably bad for a lot of publishers. I mean, yes, they're spending a lot less money, but I think you can't replace something like Gen Con.
Yeah, I'm hopeful for a lot of designers as well as publishers that this is a way to reach out to people that they wouldn't normally get to be in contact with, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of FaceTime that happens at Gen Con. I don't know how you really replace that because your days are still packed.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if your days are packed in a virtual setting, I don't know how you see more people. I guess you just see different people. I don't know. I don't know. There's something tangible about the physical that I think you're losing. Let's focus on what our listeners can do for Gen Con Online, in Gen Con Online. What can you do?
Well, first, you can go sign up for Gen Con badge, and it's free.
Yeah, absolutely. I've already signed up for my badge, so why not?
And then there are tons and tons of events, most of which you need to get tickets for. So some events are free, some events cost. Usually they don't cost very much, maybe $2, $4. And you're getting a tailored experience, you know, a small group of people with a single instructor for that price. The events that you can register for are all over the place. There are seminars, there are board game sessions, both learn to play or just come play this game, tournaments, RPG sessions. There's even crafts. Just looking through the events for Thursday, I found a thing on quilting and a thing on making felted animals.
I'm looking at some cross-stitch stuff right now.
There's a group doing dance lessons several times a day, starting with waltzing, but moving on to other forms of ballroom dancing. There's all kinds of entertainment. Literally, there are thousands of events you can sign up for. Thousands.
This whole time that you have been talking, I have been scrolling in the event list, and I've made it to Thursday at 1 p.m.
Yeah, even when I put a few restrictions on my list, I don't want adult-only events. I don't even want mature-rated events. I want stuff that's going to be family-friendly. I scrolled through 5 or 10 minutes, and I only got down to Thursday night.
Fantastic Puppets and How to Build Them with Your Kids.
Awesome.
I mean, how cool is that? There's so much really just amazing and interesting stuff in here. That was a $12 event for an hour.
So I think there's a ton of stuff there. One thing that actually caught my eye was that our friend Jim Fitzpatrick is going to be teaching people how to play his game Mission to Planet Hex.
Which is awesome.
Which is super cool. Every event in the list tells you whether it's Zoom, Discord, Tabletopia, Tabletop Simulator, how you're going to be able to access the event, and how to contact the person organizing it.
If this seems like too much for you to handle, all these events that we're talking about, there's lots of other things that you can look at when you're on that Gen Con site. They did a really good job putting everything in one place. There is a merch site right there on the Gen Con webpage. So if you like to get shirts and stuff showing that you were at that convention, you can do that stuff right there. There is a Gen Con Online show highlights page, which talks about some of the really, really popular or long-standing things. They've been doing, get this, the Gen Con costume contest for 35 years.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's crazy. But down at the bottom, they have the Twitch streams for Gen Con. Those are obviously free. It doesn't cost anything to get on Twitch and watch those. So you can see BGG Online, you can see demos and panels and live games. There's Gen Con Main Stage, Gen Con TV, and Gen Con Studio, all on Twitch. There's just so much incredible stuff available. I mean, I knew Gen Con was big, but my mind is just blown by seeing all of these events that are in there.
Thousands.
Yeah, it's crazy. So generally speaking, if there is a game that you know about that is coming out sometime soon or has just come out, you can pull up those events and just type in the name of that game. And you can find a date or a time. It might cost you $2 to get into a Tabletopia or a tabletop simulator session to be taught how to play that game and then be able to play that game as if you had gone to Gen Con itself. But the nice thing about these virtual conventions is there's usually a little bit more time. And so if you've never been to a convention, you might not know this, but a lot of the times when you go to a booth and you try to sample a game, you're getting kind of an abbreviated demo. You're getting four turns. You're getting the first round. You're getting some shorter section, some subsection that was crafted for the convention experience because they're trying to get all these people through.
Unless you're playing some short filler game, they're trying to get your experience down to 30 minutes, 20 minutes.
Right.
Maybe an hour, but for an involved game, an hour is still not enough.
And sitting down and playing a game for an hour on the show floor at a convention is
super distracting.
The exception. Well, yeah. It's the exception rather than the rule. With these, there's so much more ability to spread out and have so many more people that are helping and doing all this stuff that you can have a full game experience. Yeah, you don't have the din of people and you're not physically moving the pieces or whatever. But if you have heard of Wingspan and you want to try it out, you can go into the Gen Con event, search for Wingspan. I don't know, they might all be sold out by now, a game like that. But you could scroll down, find an event, find a time, click on that, and then you basically buy your ticket for that event. And you know that you're going to sit down, they're going to teach you how to play the game, and you're going to be able to play through the whole game from your computer. You don't have to fly to Indianapolis or drive there or whatever. You don't have to do all those things. If you don't like people, you don't have to be around a lot of people. All that stuff is just incredibly convenient. And you don't have to figure out where Stonemaier Games is on the show floor or whoever is demoing it, because that's a whole other experience.
So personally, I'm not a huge fan of online convention-y stuff because I have a hard time focusing on my computer in the middle of the day with kids running around. However, that's both a positive and a negative because it means I don't have to worry about where my kids are and what they're doing while I'm trying to demo a game. Because let me tell you, having been to enough conventions with our kids, they're great, they're well-behaved, but round about the third or fourth one, they're done, and they're like, I just want to go over there and look at the Pokemon cards, yeah, or the minis, or whatever, and I'm like, but I'm here, and I don't really want to let you out of my sight in this group of 30,000 people.
It's so funny, too, when you're standing there looking at a game, and they're right next to you, and you kind of know it, but then you like lose track of them visually, and you have that minor freak-out moment. Like,
wait, like, they're still here.
Where'd they go? Ah! You know, and you kind of do the wild grab and hope you don't grab someone's leg or something. But you're not going to do that here because they're going to be off doing their own thing. You're going to be having your fun virtual Gen Con experience.
So Gen Con online is a great experience. I would suggest that everybody at least try it. Sign up for a badge and one event. Honestly, given my own schedule, that's probably all I can manage. Mm-hmm. But I'm still going to try to at least do that much. And if you're really curious, one of the events you can sign up for is a virtual tour of Indianapolis.
That's funny.
Get a little bit more of the I'm really there experience.
So I have already volunteered to help out with the Czech Games Edition programming. They're going to be streaming games of Codenames on Codenames.game, which is actually a site that you can go to and you can play Codenames online. It's not Tabletopia or anything like that. It's actually a built web system. You can create a room and you can just play. So I don't know when that's going to be. I'll find out sometime this week before the weekend. That'll be something fun that I'll be involved in.
All right. So that's specifically Gen Con.
Yeah, let's talk about virtual conventions in general. We've kind of touched on some of the positives and negatives of this already, but I think this is something we got to talk about.
Yeah, so I already said you get to do this a little bit more on your own schedule and what works for you, and less worry about either getting somebody to babysit your kids or trying to make sure you have eyes on them the whole time that you're playing a game.
Right. So here's the deal with virtual conventions. A lot of publishers have taken the temperature of the land, no pun intended, and said, hey, why do I have to do a Gen Con thing? Why can't I just do a virtual convention? And so we've seen PortalCon. Portal Games did their own convention. We saw RenegadeCon. Renegade Game Studios did their own convention. Skybound did their own convention. There's a couple other ones that are going to be coming. I mean, we've already seen the CMON Expo. That already was its own convention anyway.
Yes.
I don't think these things are ever going away. Even when we have a vaccine for COVID or whatever the solution to the COVID dilemma is, I think virtual cons are here to stay. And I don't think it's just going to be for Origins Online, which didn't even happen this year for reasons, or Gen Con Online, or PAX Online.
PAX There's going to be a PAX Online coming in September,
in the fall,
yeah,
which is not designed to replace PAX Unplugged. It's designed to replace PAX West.
Yeah.
But that's going to be another event as well. I don't think these things are going away. And I think there's going to be more of them because one of the things about this is if a publisher is saying, all right, I got to go through all this work to put all this stuff online, I'm separated from the third party because right now, a publisher can't put together a convention for 70,000 people. A publisher can't do a PAX on their own.
Yeah, well, a publisher isn't equipped on their own to handle several thousand people and renting out the space and dealing with all of the badging and all of that. But a publisher can definitely handle something more on the line of what we would think of as like a small local convention, and all the more so if they can do it completely online.
Well, think about it like this. It's their booth. That's the only thing they have to curate. And when they can curate their booth online, they don't have to bring their booth to a place. And so they can curate the entire experience.
Sure.
So they don't have to worry about travel and badging and all this other stuff, any of the infrastructure that goes into a convention. And so I think you're going to see more of these publishers realizing, hey, I can break this apart and do my own thing. I don't have to share the spotlight with anybody else. I can do it on my own time. I don't have to rush to get my games ready to go for the convention because, worst case scenario, we push our convention by a week or something like that.
I mean, I think big conventions like Origins and Gen Con and PAX Unplugged are still going to be behemoths in the industry and Spiel. I mean, come on.
Yes. I'm not saying they're going away. By the way, there's going to be a digital Spiel this year as well.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that those are going away. I'm just saying that there may be smaller publishers that don't go to those conventions because they can get a sufficient amount of online exposure because there's such a huge cost for publishers to go to these conventions. And if they're not getting ROI, they're going to find another way to do it. And if they can get exposure through a digital space, why wouldn't you do that?
So I think there's pluses and minuses even there because if you're a big enough publisher to have several games and put on your own thing, then hopefully you've got some name recognition, some word of mouth.
Sure.
The really small publishers, they can afford to put together the online presence, but people need to know about them to be able to come. And that is one of the purposes of getting on the exhibitor floor in a big convention.
Yep. No, you're 100% right.
I have never heard of you before. What's your deal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think you're going to see tiny publishers doing online digital things, although there are services out there that will facilitate that. In fact, tabletop.game was just purchased by BGG.
Mm.
And it is a service that facilitates online conventioning. Many people have used them over the years and been very happy with them. And if they're being consumed by an organization that's as prominent in the industry as Board Game Geek, you have to think that that's going to be leveraging some services for some of those smaller publishers.
On the flip side, with this sudden proliferation of virtual conventions, and knowing that they'll probably get bigger, or even if we go back to lots of big in-person conventions, like you said, these online conventions aren't going to go away now. People are going to see the benefits of them. It might still be really hard to see all the stuff you want to see. We've already seen this outside of virtual space that if you have two conventions at the same time, you physically literally can't get there.
Right.
Like, you can't do it. The bigger problem for publishers, but also a problem for board game media and other folks. Online conventions make it easier to see all the stuff you want to see. But conventions in general are still really important for that idea of bringing lots of people together, whether it's in person or virtually.
So here's one of the big things about virtual conventions. Virtual conventions work really, really well for someone who is good at planning.
So you and not me.
Think about the convention experience. You walk down a hall, you go from booth to booth, and you say, oh, I know who you are. Oh, I know who you are. Oh, I know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And you encounter it as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
That browsing experience in the virtual arena is not quite the same.
I'm going to admit I feel pretty overwhelmed by that list of Gen Con events.
Totally.
I'm not sure how to cut it down to find what I really am going to be interested
in. But here's the thing. The way that you're going to cut it down is by using terms of things that you already know.
Right.
So that incidental exposure to a new game is going to be a lot more difficult.
Yes. Well, and it's one of the reasons I really like the smaller online convention experience of like a Gen Cant. They have one event scheduled at a time. They're publicizing exactly what those are. And you'll look at the list there and say, oh, hey, I've never heard of that game, but I'm free at that time. Why don't I check it out?
Pretty much. So This is going to be very much drinking from the fire hose this week. If listening to this podcast makes you interested in Gen Con Online and you haven't really thought about it yet, just sit down before you start to browse. I think that's the biggest thing that I can really say. I think it actually is really fun. It is such a diverse collection of things that you can possibly do. It's fascinating to look through the list, and maybe you will find something you're like, oh, hey, this thing is really neat sounding. I wonder what it is. If you're like me, you're probably going to scroll and then like right-click, open a new tab, right-click, open a new tab, and then you're going to have like 35 tabs, and you have to go through each one of them and figure out which ones you actually care about, and you whittle them down, and then maybe you sign up for an event or two. That's probably how I'm going to do it. But there's other people who have weighed in on the best ways that you can navigate the online convention experience.
Yeah, we found two really great resources over at Meeple Mountain.
Andy Matthews runs a great site over there.
Yep. Gary Chavez wrote a piece with his top 6 tips for attending an online board game convention. And I found it really, really useful to kind of get my head wrapped around this, because it includes understanding what your events are you're registering for, how to communicate before and after the event, how to communicate during the event, where to find the right information to understand that, and a little bit of breakdown of Tabletop Simulator, Tabletopia, other game platforms. And Gary, at least, says he's been having a really great time with online conventions over the last couple of months.
Yeah, it's really a mentality shift. And if it's something that you're prepared for, I think it's something that you can get into and you can really enjoy. And it's nice because it is a space where you can sit there with a kid on your lap or a kid sitting in the chair next to you, and you can both experience something at the same time. But if they need to run off to go to the bathroom, you don't have to stop your game, send someone off to go with that person to the bathroom and come back or whatever. Or if they're hungry, you can have them run off and grab whatever. Like, it's so much more approachable because you're in a familiar space, and yet you have the exposure to so many of these things, as long as you're mentally prepared to experience them in a different way.
Sounds good.
So buckle up, because there's going to be a lot of virtual conventions in the future.
Again, Meeple Mountain has a whole list of conventions. We will link specifically to their list of online conventions. So if Gen Con seems too intimidating, or if you're busy this weekend,
right,
but you like the idea of an online con sometime in the future, check out that list and see if there's a different one that you'd be interested in trying out.
And at this point, it's gotten so big that people are just putting in comments and saying, please add this convention, please add that convention. And so it's getting updated fairly frequently.
Well, we would love to hear what you think about online conventions. Have you been to any this year?
Are you going to Gen Con this weekend?
Are you going to Gen Can't instead? Are you doing both?
You can do both.
This year, we all Gen Can.
That's right. Absolutely. There's lots of different ways that you can let us know. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at FamilyGamersAA. Or you can head over to our community.
We'll definitely be talking about Gen Con and Gen Can't there. The easiest way to get there is to go to thefamilygamers.com/community.
If you'd like to send us some direct feedback, you can always email us, andrew@thefamilygamers.com.
anitra@thefamilygamers.com.
Please don't forget to subscribe to the show, tell your friends about the show, and leave us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell your virtual friends that you meet at Gen Con about
the show.
Right,
because we're not really here. We're virtual. I forgot about that.
Yeah, right?
Yes.
So tell your virtual friends about this podcast you love, about playing real games with your real kids.
Yes.
Yes.
All of those things. Another thing that is real is our sponsorship. The Family Gamers is sponsored by First Move Financial. Head over to firstmovefinancial.com/FamilyGamers to learn how the team at First Move Financial can help you pile up the victory points.
That's going to be it for this week, and I think that's plenty.
It is a lot.
Until next week, play games with your kids.